Palestinians for at least 5 months. But at the time, this was in the February to March timeframe, the Israelis were not allowing flour into Gaza because they said it was going to the UN's branch there that had been accused of having ties to Hamas. So they were not allowing the flour in. And this is the kind of thing that was really bothering USAID and frustrating their efforts. They couldn't get food in, they couldn't get medicine in, other supplies. A lot of their trucks from like the Red Crescent, other humanitarian groups were being turned around because of items in there the Israelis were not allowing in. Aid workers had been killed. Their convoys had been targeted. These were all the types of examples that USAID was telling Secretary Blinken.
And basically, there's no recourse now, right? Because it's done? Or is there anything that the Biden administration could now do differently?
Yeah, the law is not, it was not just a one-time shot. And this is what the U.S. government said, too, in response. They said, we're always assessing the situation. They said that they believed that the situation was improving since after they applied leverage with this. The folks I talked to, both inside of government and in the humanitarian world, said that's not true at all. The situation is as bad as it's ever been, including since the Rafah incursion. But this law does not only have, you know, whenever Blinken addresses Congress to it, it can be applied at any point.
That they could cut off, that the U.S. government could cut off aid to military arms to Israel.
Absolutely. If it assesses that the Israelis are deliberately blocking humanitarian assistance at any point, they can apply this law. That's right.
Brett Murphy, we want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, September 30th at 5:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, states are trying to crack down on attempts to threaten voters as the election draws closer. Washington voters will decide whether to repeal a tax in their state. And a crackdown on a company accused of taking advantage of rising rent prices in the Northwest and across the country. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 26, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. We're just weeks before November's election, and some states are trying to do more to prevent intimidation of voters. Suzanne Potter looks at the Freedom from Intimidation in Elections Act, which would limit the ability to openly carry a gun near polling places.
With the election 6 weeks away, concern is building about attempts to intimidate voters at the polls, so lawmakers are taking action at the state and federal levels. Governor Gavin Newsom signed the Peace Act, which makes California the first state in the nation to state explicitly that open carrying a gun in or near a polling place constitutes illegal harassment. Sean Morales Doyle is director of the Voting Rights Program for the nonprofit Brennan Center for Justice.
that represents some really common sense principles. All voters, all election workers should be able to participate and run our democracy free from intimidation. And visible guns around our elections are intimidating.
A recent survey of election workers from the Brennan Center found that 40% report being subject to threats, abuse, or harassment. California Senator Alex Padilla introduced a bill to ban open carry of firearms in polling places nationwide, noting the country has a long history of scare tactics on Election Day.
There's individuals out there stoked by partisan rhetoric and false narratives about election fraud that have taken it upon themselves to either discourage at a minimum or sometimes outright intimidate people into not letting their voice be heard in the democratic process.
Both political parties plan to have poll watchers present this year. The Brennan Center has set up a hotline at 866-OUR-VOTE for people to report any efforts to intimidate voters or election workers. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Voters in Washington state have a big decision on their hands. Eric Tegadoff reports they'll decide whether to repeal their state's capital gains tax.
The election is less than 6 weeks away, and Washingtonians will be deciding on a slate of initiatives, including one measure that will impact funding that supports children. Initiative 2109 would repeal a 7% tax on capital gains for assets worth more than $262,000. The repeal has support from hedge fund manager Brian Haywood, who says it's a slippery slope toward a state income tax, which the state doesn't have. But Gabriela Quintana says fewer than 4,000 people in the state pay the tax.
It's a very privileged move to be able to fund these initiatives for your own needs and to not think about the impact this will have on a huge majority in Washington state.
Last year, the tax pulled in about $786 million. The first $500 million collected from it goes towards schools, early learning, and child care. Money collected beyond that goes towards school construction. Justin Fox Bailey is a teacher and head of the Snohomish Education Association. He says the vast majority of Washingtonians who don't pay the capital gains tax will be impacted if Initiative 2109 passes, especially kids.
They're going to feel it in their communities when we give a tax cut to these millionaires and billionaires and you don't have the same access to childcare. Your kid's school isn't getting updated. Public services are being cut or reduced.
Washington has historically had one of the most regressive tax systems in the country, and a recent report found the lowest income 20% pay more than three times as much of their income as the top 1%. Quintana says the capital gains tax is vital for the state.
We all need to play a role, including the wealthy individuals, and repealing it will only really hurt families and children.
Ballots start going out on October 18th. I'm Eric Tegadoff.
The Federal Trade Commission's reached a settlement with Invitation Homes, requiring the company to pay approximately $48 million. The company is the country's largest landlord of single-family homes. According to Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, the growing problem of hedge funds purchasing single-family homes has made a big mark targeting single mothers and black families especially. The goal is for families, he says, to have a fair chance to buy homes and rent at a fair price. Merkley says investors are buying homes and transforming them into Airbnbs, leaving families helpless in finding a place to stay. This week, I joined Senator Merkley and Federal Trade Commission Chair Lena Khan to find out more about this issue.
We're standing up to billionaire investors who are exploiting the American people for their own profit. The Federal Trade Commission reached a settlement with Invitation Homes, the country's largest landlord of single-family homes, requiring the company to pay $1 million for deceiving renters, charging junk fees, withholding security deposits, and other abuses. It's a win for families. Well done. But let's be clear. These abuses are symptoms of a much larger problem. Huge corporate investors, propped up by hedge funds, have invaded our housing market, and they're using their massive wealth to buy up single-family homes across the country. When you see all cash offers on homes or all cash, no inspection offers, probably a hedge fund. They're driving up the price to buy a home, putting a stake through the heart of the dream of home ownership. They're driving up the rents, pouring fuel on the fire of our housing affordability crisis. Houses in our communities should be homes for families, not profit centers for hedge funds. Invitation Homes has bought up more single family homes in the U.S. than anyone else. I believe that number now exceeds 80,000 homes. 2 weeks ago, on September 9th, Invitation Homes announced they had purchased 580 newly constructed single-family homes in Tampa, Denver, and the Carolinas for a total of $216 million to turn into rentals. One company can mobilize hundreds of millions of dollars from the hedge fund industry, buy hundreds of homes before families ever get a chance to inspect them and see if they would like to become a homeowner, which means 580 families that could be homeowners are instead paying into the profits of billionaire investors instead of their home's equity. It's just wrong. You know, homeownership, it built the American middle class. Hedge funds are now trying to take that slice of the American economy that was the biggest source of wealth for working families off of the plate of working families and put it on to the already fully stacked plate of the millionaires and billionaires. Studies show that these predatory hedge funds disproportionately target Black families and single mothers. The hedge funds are much more likely than small landlords to file for evictions. They often impose high rent increase, inflated fees, and minimize maintenance to maximize their profits. And that's what the FTC found with Invitation Homes. One Invitation Homes employee even admitted that they aggressively charged residents because it was, quote, investors needed to see the maximum profit. These abuses are what happens when we allow hedge funds or large corporations in the single family housing market. And it's why I'm striving to kick them out. I've introduced the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act to, first, ban hedge funds from buying any more single-family homes. Second, to require them to sell the homes they own 10% a year over 10 years. And third, ban them from the housing market entirely. The American people are incredibly fortunate to have Lina Khan as chair of the FTC.
Thank you so much, Senator Merkley, for inviting me to talk about the work that the FTC is doing to ensure that Americans are not illegally paying inflated rents or illegally being kicked out of their homes. Affordable housing is just such a critical issue, and one that Senator Merkley has been championing personally for decades. As a volunteer with and then leader of Habitat for Humanity in Oregon, he brought that same dedication for Americans in the Senate. I was especially appreciative as we were navigating the financial crisis, just what a bold and courageous voice he was, pushing to make sure that we were not navigating the aftermath of the financial crisis in the way that would just enrich financial institutions at the expense of everyday working Americans. The FTC announced a major action against the largest corporate landlord of single-family homes in the country, Invitation Homes, which owns 80,000 units across the country. Our investigation uncovered a whole raft of really predatory and abusive tactics. Invitation Homes was charging people hidden junk fees, deceiving people about how much they'd have to pay every month, so people would see one amount for the rent, and then after they had signed the lease, sometimes would learn that they'd be hundreds of dollars in junk fees that people had not budgeted for, the company unjustly withholding people's security deposits, and even initiating eviction proceedings against people during the pandemic while the CDC moratorium was in place. So really just an atrocious set of practices that Americans had to deal with. Because of the FTC's action here, we were securing close to $50 million from Invitation Homes. This fund will be designed to make sure that people who were harmed by its practices can get some compensation.
Were there any situations specifically in the Pacific Northwest by this company abusing renters that we know of?
I can answer that. My understanding is they have homes in Washington and in California. And I'll leave it to Chair Khan to expand on that.
That's right. Seattle is a place where there's a decent presence, as well as parts of California, Southern California. So there is a West Coast impact here for sure.
And Annette, as I've been holding my 36 town halls, one in each county, and I mentioned this issue, boy, does it resonate. And I was out in Baker, and I said, this is probably not an issue that's impacting you here, but it has a big impact across our state, certainly, and across the nation. And the response was, actually, it is affecting us here in Baker, Oregon. Investors are buying up the homes and turning them into Airbnbs, leaving few homes on the market to rent or to buy. So, and we do know that the rate at which investors are buying homes in Oregon has gone up. I'm encouraging the state legislature to pass a transparency law that would help us better identify who are buying homes in Oregon. We have the data to understand this issue better. We know in some markets, the hedge funds or large investors are buying somewhere around 40% of the homes for sale. Wow. It is now estimated that the large investors will own 50% of the rental homes in America by the end of this decade. That's just 6 years away. So this is a very significant issue across the nation and certainly here in Oregon.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. Also this week, a doctor from Oregon testified on Capitol Hill, telling senators why she and her family had to leave the state of Idaho.
My name is Dr. Amelia Huntsberger, and I'm a board-certified OBGYN. I currently live and work in Oregon, but previously practiced medicine in rural Idaho for more than a decade. I provide PAP screening, STI testing and treatment, and prenatal care. I prescribe contraception, and I treat infertility. I deliver babies, and I provide abortion care. I grew up in rural Washington, and I met my husband, who also grew up in a small town, during medical school. For 11 years, we practiced medicine in Sandpoint, a town of 9,000 in Idaho. It was my privilege to serve my community. All people deserve high-quality health care, no matter where they live. Idaho has enacted some of the strictest abortion restrictions in the country, without exceptions to allow doctors to act to preserve a pregnant patient's health, not even to prevent harm to organs or function, like fertility, unless an abortion is necessary to prevent. Once the total abortion ban went into effect post-Dobbs, it no longer felt like a safe place to practice medicine. There was widespread confusion and lack of consensus about Idaho's abortion laws among the medical and legal community. The risk of criminal prosecution and civil penalties immediately felt very real for my husband, who is an emergency medicine physician, and for me as an OBGYN. Delaying or not providing standard evidence-based medical care also puts physicians like us at risk for medical malpractice charges. These laws forced us to consider what would happen to our children if both of their parents went to jail. Many doctors in Idaho, like me, tried to raise awareness of the harm from the abortion bans. I naively thought that if people just understood the laws, as a result of talking publicly about abortion, we began to fear for the safety of our family. Just over a year ago, we packed our things and moved to Oregon, taking our children away from the only place that they had ever called home. A week after we gave our notice, hospital administrators decided to close the labor and delivery unit at our critical access hospital. The hospital cited the abortion laws as one factor in the decision. All three of my OBGYN partners left, each going to a state without abortion restrictions. During my last year in Idaho, I took care of two pregnant patients who were living in their cars and a third who lived in a tent. When the labor and delivery unit at the hospital closed, the impact on the community was staggering, but it was most profound on already vulnerable groups. 22% of the OBGYNs have left Idaho since the bans went into effect. 55% of maternal fetal medicine doctors, the high-risk pregnancy experts, have left Idaho. Three labor and delivery units have closed. Abortion is at times necessary to protect patients' health and their lives. What is unsafe is allowing the government to make healthcare decisions for patients and preventing doctors from treating patients who need care. Abortion bans make pregnancy more dangerous and exacerbate our country's maternal mortality crisis. Most maternal deaths are preventable. At no point in pregnancy is any politician more qualified to make healthcare decisions than a patient and their doctor.
That was Dr. Amelia Huntsberger from Oregon. She testified before the U.S. Senate Finance Committee, where the chairman is Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
Women in America are faced with the prospect of losing yet another pillar of reproductive care, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. With the help of Senate Republicans, Donald Trump confirmed three far-right justices to the Supreme Court. Each of them swore up and down that Roe was settled law, that there wasn't any threat to any facet of reproductive freedom. Each of these judges threw those pledges they took under Senate oath into the trash and gutted Roe at the very first opportunity. The consequences of that decision, while predictable, are gut-wrenching. Women are miscarrying, suffering life-threatening blood loss, losing their ability to bear future children, or dying because they were denied the emergency medical care that they needed. Doctors are being targeted or forced to relocate to states where they can practice basic medicine without fear of a legal witch hunt. Earlier this year, when Alabama State Supreme Court handed down a ruling that effectively banned IVF in that state. All of this was made possible by abortion bans that went into effect under Donald Trump after his Supreme Court gutted the Roe decision. So that brings us to EMTALA, over which this committee has black letter law jurisdiction. This law guarantees that anyone entering a hospital that receives Medicare funding, which is most hospitals in America, will get the emergency health care they need, reproductive or otherwise. A woman may come into the emergency room with an ectopic pregnancy or bleeding out from a miscarriage, and EMTALA is what ensures that she gets the necessary care. It also protects the doctor, who has a sworn oath to provide that care, even in states where an abortion ban is in effect. Some states that have passed abortion bans into law claim that they contain exceptions for emergency care if a woman's life is at risk. In reality, these exceptions are forcing doctors to play lawyer and lawyers to play doctor. Providers are scrambling to make impossible decisions between providing critical care or a potential jail sentence, and hospital lawyers are being forced to make medical decisions they have no business making. While providers and lawyers struggle to interpret a patchwork of state and federal laws that dictate whether a woman should live or die in America, patients are going without the care that they urgently need. These exceptions, in my view, aren't worth the paper they're written on. In June, the Supreme Court heard arguments on Idaho's abortion ban, which denies women the right to receive emergency reproductive care as guaranteed under the EMTALA law. The Supreme Court missed the case on legal technicalities, effectively kicking the can down the road, biding its time until the far right can cherry-pick another case that will clear the necessary judicial hurdles. When they find it, they'll bulldoze existing law and set a new precedent that allows states like Idaho to let women die waiting for care rather than giving them the treatment they need. Donald Trump is still bragging about having successfully overturned this mainstay of women's health care. His running mate, J.D. Vance, has thrown his support behind some of the most extreme positions on this issue, like a national abortion ban and uterus surveillance, tracking a woman's medical records to determine if she'd receive abortion care. And Project 2025, which appears to now be the guiding doctrine of some in the Republican Party, promises to reverse EMTALA's protections for emergency abortion care. On a personal note, I can't believe that all these years later, we're still debating whether women ought to be able to make their own health care decisions.
And that was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airways. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy and down to 57. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy to partly cloudy skies, a high of 74. Today in history, on this date in 1960, Kennedy and Nixon squared off in the first ever televised presidential debate. Our quote of the day is from Kennedy, who said, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate." Knowledge is power during Workplace Rights Week. Mike Moen reports the pandemic helped bring workers' rights back to the forefront.
From COVID precautions to emerging technology, labor voices say there's some key information some workers might not be aware of. Over the past year, Minnesota has phased in new laws such as earned sick time requirements, which mandate 1 hour of fully paid sick time for every 30 hours worked. As COVID activity continues to circulate and with the cold and flu season almost here, Jeff Ambrose of the Minnesota Training Partnership says people should know this requirement is pretty expansive.
This isn't only sick time for yourself, but it's time that you can use to care for a sick family member, to get help if you were victim of domestic abuse or stalking.
Workers also are encouraged to see if they can use their earned time for things like vaccination appointments. Ambrose notes workplace environments are constantly changing with new equipment and technology. He says staff should maintain conversations amongst each other, elected officials, and, if applicable, union representatives in the event such changes harm a workplace setting. Over the summer, Minnesota also implemented a change that expands penalties and legal options in cases where a company misclassifies an employee as an independent contractor. John Swanson, who is with the state affiliate of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, says these have long been pervasive issues, especially in the construction trades.
Some things that should be common sense. We have to have laws now to protect people from being taken advantage of.
A misclassified worker can miss out on things like health coverage and overtime pay. This is Mike Moen.
President Biden says an all-out war is a threat in the Middle East as tensions rise. Congress avoids a government shutdown, sending stopgap funding to the president's desk. And an elections expert calls Georgia's latest election rule a really bad idea. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
I'm a very strong supporter of Israel. I make no bones about it. I said years ago I was a Zionist. All a Zionist means is that there needs to be an Israel.
President Joe Biden says all-out war is possible in the Middle East as conflict between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah escalates. But in remarks to the UN Tuesday, he said getting a ceasefire in Lebanon could also curb the fighting between Israel and Hamas. The war in Gaza is approaching its one-year anniversary. The House on Wednesday voted to avoid a government shutdown by approving a three-month stopgap funding bill. Right-wing Texas Congressman Chip Roy was one of more than 80 Republicans voting no, saying Congress uses the calendar to dodge tough spending choices.
2 years ago in 2022, a $1.7 trillion omnibus bill was passed when? December 23rd. That is not an accident. It's by design. It's on purpose.
The Senate passed the continuing resolution, delivering it to Biden's desk ahead of the September 30th deadline. The Republican Secretary of State and Attorney General are joining those opposed to a recent Georgia Election Board ruling. The rule, now being challenged in court, requires hand-counting ballots after the machine tally. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says it's a bad idea because even under the best circumstances, human beings are not good at counting pieces of paper.
It's likely that those errors or perceptions of errors, which will be easily reconciled under pre-existing policies that Georgia had enacted, that those will fuel disinformation spread by the losing candidate.
Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in the former Rust Belt city of Pittsburgh on Wednesday. She says she wants tax credits for companies who add good union jobs in steel, iron, and manufacturing.
No one who grows up in America's greatest industrial or agricultural centers should be abandoned.
Harris said she wants education to shift from focusing on degrees towards more skill training, something she hopes gains traction with the private sector. Singer and rising pop star Chapel Roan took to TikTok to say she'll vote for Harris, but with deep reservations. Roan says she can't vote for former President Donald Trump, but is hardly happy with the Democrat.
Because there is no way I can stand behind some of the left's completely transphobic and completely genocidal views.
The nonprofit Haitian Bridge Alliance in Springfield, Ohio, has filed citizen criminal charges against Trump and his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. The group's Gerlin Joseph says they hold the candidates responsible for the chaos and threats to the community over the conspiracy theory that legal migrants are eating people's pets.
The disrespect that they continue to bring is just unacceptable.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
A federal appeals court hears arguments in a Utah monuments case. Tribal leaders testify at the U.S. Senate for a revival of a Radiation Exposure Act. And a new Native Health Hub in South Dakota seeks to create new doctors. With more on the stories impacting our Native communities, here's Antonia Gonzalez.
A federal appeals court is hearing arguments in Colorado in a lawsuit over two of the largest national monuments in the Mountain West region. Rachel Cohen reports.
Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in southern Utah include vast red rock canyons and cliffs, as well as Native American cultural sites.
Kivas, the pictographs, the actual migration routes and trails themselves. I can't imagine a place that's more worthy of protection.
Matthew Campbell is an attorney representing the Hopi, Ute Mountain Ute, and Pueblo of Zuni, which are intervening in the litigation on the side of the federal government. The case started when former President Trump shrunk both monuments in 2017. Then, a few years later, the Biden administration restored them. The state of Utah sued, saying Biden overstepped his authority under the 1906 Antiquities Act, in part because the monuments are too big. Yet the court hearings in Colorado probably won't get to this dispute and will instead focus on questions like whether the court is able to overrule the president's judgment on monuments. I'm Rachel Cohen.
Tribal members and advocates traveled to Washington, D.C. this week to ask lawmakers to revive the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, known as RECA. The bill passed the Senate but has been stalled in the House after expiring months ago. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has this report.
Wednesday, tribal members and allies delivered symbolic health care invoices to House Speaker Mike Johnson's office to point out the multi-generational cost for their families dealing with cancer due to radiation exposure. Once inside, advocates pressed for Speaker Johnson to bring up the bill for a vote. Outside, advocates like Kathleen Sosi prayed for a new path forward.
I prayed for Speaker Mike Johnson to change his mind and have the heart and the compassion, as well as the House of Representatives, to change their mind and approve the RECA bill.
It was a stark contrast to Tuesday's meeting with senators who have passed expanded versions of the RECA bill and representatives who say they have the votes to pass it if Johnson would bring it to the floor for a vote. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Trust and visibility are keys to effective health care, but not everyone feels the same way walking into the doctor's office. That's why some are looking to increase representation among healthcare professionals. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
The new Great Plains Native Health Hub in Rapid City aims to create a safe space for Indigenous patients, but it also wants to be a resource to aspiring healthcare professionals. Dr. Donald Warren is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health, a key piece of the new Native Health Hub.
What we're excited about is bringing together many of our people who have studied in different parts of the country or worked in different parts of the country but have roots here in South Dakota. And bringing our team back here to conduct this work is very exciting. So what we're hoping is, again, we'll link the research opportunities to educational opportunities.
Warren says Indigenous First Healthcare makes a tangible difference for Native patients.
What we're recognizing when we blend together the best of our traditional cultural values with the best of modern science, we create all kinds of opportunities and synergies to improve outcomes.
Warren's colleague, Dr. Courtney Clausen, says while it is a difficult path, Native students shouldn't write off healthcare as an unachievable career field.
Incredibly